I'm Mercedes Hutton, and you're listening to Yumcha, a podcast from Hong Kong Free Press. This week, a city between East and West, with Vodene, England. Hong Kong is so often discussed in dichotomies: East and West, old and new, rich and poor, Chinese and British. But much of the city exists in the nuanced, liminal space amid these oppositions. And it is in this in-between space that journalist-turned-historian Vodene, England lingers in her latest book, Fortune's Bazaar: The Making of Hong Kong. Described by publisher Simon & Schuster as a tale of empire, race and sex, Vodene takes us back to the port city's genesis, to a place where people from across Eurasia came, settled and built, both literally and conceptually. Often previously untold, their narratives weave multiculturalism into Hong Kong's origin story and reveal much about what made it into the city it is today.
The real genesis of this book goes back, weirdly enough, to 1979. My parents were in Hong Kong for 10 years, and being of a religious persuasion, they were going to Jordan Road Church, where they got to know a man called Carl Smith. And my mum would bring him home for lunch on Sunday after church, thinking she needed to feed him up. I mean, he was huge already, but nonetheless. And the point about Carl Smith is that he's really the father, the sort of doyen of a particular way of doing Hong Kong history. And it starts from him being, and I mean this in the nicest possible way, quite obsessive. His actual job, he was sent from America to sort of train up a new generation of Chinese priests. But he kind of got waylaid. He was thinking, well, you know, who are they going to be preaching to? You know, who actually are the people of Hong Kong? And so he had this apartment in Mei Fu, and it was not huge, but every single wall was covered with those little drawers that are built just the size for index cards. This was all long pre-internet. And basically there was an index card on just about every individual who had lived in Hong Kong from the beginning. And he had compiled this incredible resource, which grew and grew like Topsy. It's now got a whole life of its own long past his death, by going through, you know, back in the day, newspapers would have birth, death and marriage notices, and he would scour all of these and he would make notes. And oh, so Leonardo Delmada married this Remedios lady, and then they had kids and those kids married. You know, he tracked all this out. I mean, absolutely forensically. And he gradually learned and realized, oh, you know, actually these people of Hong Kong are incredibly diverse. They're from all over the place. They're all mixing and mingling. And he didn't just look at newspapers. He would spend months, years sometimes in the land registry, tracking exactly, you know, land lot by land lot, apartment by apartment, all through Hong Kong, who owned what and who transferred it to whom. And, you know, I mean, obsessive is perhaps an understatement. And then he'd go into other legal records. He would, you know, anything that was recorded in any way that would give any insight into, you know, really this basic question, who are the people of Hong Kong? Carl would make a note of it. And of course, I was busy starting out in daily news and journalism, and I wasn't really, I mean, I liked the man, and I was told to help out every now and then with transcribing tapes or something or other, or trying to decipher his notes. Mm. But I do recall that my mum did say to me at one point, she said, if nobody else takes control of this, you know, you're going to have to deal with Carl's cards. And it wasn't what I was looking to hear at that time in my life, but never mind. Over the years, whatever project came up that I was busy with, there was a book I did about 25 years ago about a man called Noel Croucher, who I had, of course, never heard of at that point. So I call up Carl and I say, what do you think, Noel Croucher? And he goes, and he goes into his index cards and he said, oh, yes. He was a post office clerk in 1905, you know, which is the whole story of Croucher in a nutshell, basically, that he became a millionaire and left all his money to this academic foundation. Mm-hmm. But there he is, a white guy, an English guy, at the age of 15, working as a clerk in the post office in the colony of Hong Kong. Oh, so not all English people are rich and powerful. They're not all educated. They also worked, you know, his closest colleagues were Portuguese in the post office. And then how did this guy Croucher get from that to becoming the chairman of the stock exchange and going through all the wars of Hong Kong and you know, was then called the sort of richest white man east of Suez, you know, back when you could say such things. So Paul Smith is the first and most fundamental starting point for anybody who wants to know the genuine history of Hong Kong, not just only from the ground up, but from the point of view of Hong Kong. Because what you decide is the history of a place really depends on where you stand. If you're sitting in London at the Foreign Office, you think that Hong Kong's all about the marvelous governors and, you know, the roads we built and blah, blah, blah. If you're sitting in Beijing, you think the history of Hong Kong is something else again. And you talk about the century of humiliation and you see it as a pesky blot that needs to be sorted out. But if you're standing in Hong Kong, or you know, even more specifically in Mei Fu, or you know, on Peel Street, just up from Central on the island, and you really look around very carefully and you find out who owned that building 100 years ago, and you discover, oh, well, it was these half a dozen working women. That is all thanks to Carl that we've started to look at Hong Kong in that way. And he has spawned you know, a couple of generations of scholars who look at Hong Kong from this perspective.
What happened to all of his index cards?
Excellent question. And don't panic. It's all under control.
Okay.
And luckily, I personally did not need to transcribe them. So step by step, you know, what he was building, you know, people gradually realized the importance and the significance of it. The actual original cards physically are in the special room at the Central Library, you know, in Causeway Bay. Meanwhile, they've all been scanned and digitized. There's a set at the Library of Congress in the States. You can access them through the Public Records Office in Hong Kong, which is in
Okay.
Kwun Tong. There's a project that's just beginning, and I don't know enough details about it, to do with something else, the Hong Kong History Centre, which is now based at the University of Bristol, but it's funded by several marvelous Hong Kong philanthropists. And it takes young, bright Hong Kongers over to Bristol to do their PhDs in Hong Kong history. And a couple of these who now have their PhDs are coming back to Hong Kong and they're doing a whole new project to really take the whole Carl Smith system to a higher level.
Close to the beginning of Fortune's Bazaar, you mentioned that you'd kind of had this idea of exploring what Eurasians were to Hong Kong, and it proved to be a fool's errand because it was not possible to define in such a way.
Yeah, well, I mean, you quickly hit all sorts of roadblocks when, you know, is this a racial definition and does race exist? So it's a bit of a nightmare when you first start thinking, because this general subject area, of course, was something that I was interested in, as you now know, for a long time. But specifically, I had been talking with a man called Ron Zimmern, who is the direct grandson of the sort of leading pre-war Eurasian Sir Robert Coatwell. So his grandson, Ron, is a retired medical and legal academic in Britain, but he would often visit Hong Kong. And the Zimmerns and the Coatwells, these families have been around a long time, and there are all sorts of relatives all over the place. And initially we had talked about, gosh, should we do a biography of Coatwell? But as is often the case, and frankly, anybody's family, not just Eurasian families, well, you know, some people like the idea, but other people are going to be nervous about what might come out. Ron was saying also, but you know, there's no really serious history of the Eurasians of Hong Kong. Now, when members of those families say that, they mean people like them, which means, in a way, the elite, we're talking old money, but they were basically the late 19th century, early 20th century elite of Hong Kong. Everyone's heard of Robert Ho Tung and the whole Ho Tung family, and then how it all filters out through the Hos, the Lows, the Ho Tungs, the Lies, the Luis, the Huis. So, you know, there's a whole sort of network there, or web. And it's not true to say that it's not been done. Family memoirs have been coming out. The absolute pioneer in this department is Peter Hall, who is also a product of this whole sprawling Eurasian elite clan business. He, against quite a lot of opposition, both in his own family and through the wider community, came out and privately published a book called In the Web, which he has since updated. And it was the first, you know, nothing is ever perfect. You know, people suddenly, oh, no, no, wait, he had five more concubines. You know, I mean, it's not possible to have everything accurate all the time. But he kind of broke the taboo on looking at these things. And that taboo has to do with the fact that by saying, I'm a Eurasian, you are basically saying that at some point your grandmother or your great-grandmother was a sex worker of one kind or another. At the very least, she slept with foreigners, and she probably did so for money. It's hard to imagine, frankly, why else she would in some circles. And hence taboo and sort of shame, oh, let's not sort of talk about it. But on the other hand, of course, everyone knows you're Eurasian. So, and Peter Hall's view was, this is my family, let's kind of get over it. Mm-hmm. So Peter Hall started a field of family memoir, and there have been some good ones since then. But there had been no sort of scholarly look at the field. So, okay, you sit down and think, all right, I'm going to do a history of the Eurasians of Hong Kong. Well, who exactly and why? Why do you choose these people and not those people? And what I knew was I didn't want to just talk about this particular clutch of rich old money families. Because the other point about people like Carl Smith and my parents is that they don't just want to talk about the people. They are of the people, for the people, and by the people. So you can't just hang around and talk about elites. And also, more to the point, is that, well, there were lots of other people who I found interesting, and I thought, how am I going to include them? Then you get to Armenians, like Chater, you know, Chater Road, Chater House. I mean, he's fundamental to making Hong Kong Island in so many ways, and Kowloon, actually, and the New Territories, now we think about it. Anyway. And he's an Armenian from Calcutta. So that's kind of interesting. And then his best friend is Modi, who's a Parsi. And, you know, I had to sit down and read books about Armenia and you know, what is a Parsi? Well, of course, they originally out of Persia. Zoroastrians worshipping the sun, putting their dead out on high places for vultures. But they were hugely persecuted at a certain time, basically had to leave Persia. A lot of them ended out in northwest India. And as with any community, there's always schisms within, you know, did they stay pure and only intermarry with other Parsis? Well, I think by the time you've had several generations of northwest India, that would be a hard line to hold. But the point is that from northwest India, they became absolute, I wouldn't say just handmaidens to world trade, but the crucial ingredient, the sort of key lubricant to connecting various different foreign traders coming by with all sorts of local markets and local resources also. They were brilliant intermediaries, first with the Portuguese and then with the British, and Jardines would not have happened without this leading Parsi, Jamset Gigi boy. So these Parsis are fundamental also to the making of Hong Kong. So how do you include all these people in the definition of Eurasians? And that's why I end out with a geographical concept that, well, actually, hang on a bit, Eurasia as a physical thing, that includes Armenia, Persia, you know, it's the whole continent. And the Jews that came through Baghdad or came out of Venice or, you know, whether they're Ashkenazi, maybe from Eastern Europe, or Sephardic from Spain. Eurasian, in this broader sense, therefore covers all the people I wanted to talk about. And I think the point is simply to then show how all these really diverse networks were not only diverse within themselves, but started mixing with each other. So this very conventional notion, oh, if you're Eurasian, that means, you know, your dad is white and your mom is Chinese, doesn't hold. Because, for example, Kotwal, it's the marriage of a Parsi to a Chinese woman. And Ratanjis is Parsi Chinese mix. And then you realize, oh, now hang on a bit, who's actually staffing the ships that are first coming into the Hong Kong harbor in the 1840s? And mostly they're what were called Lascars, which is another one of these loose terms. It can mean something quite specific or quite broad. But let's say mainly Muslim or different kinds of Indian sailors and seamen, but also Malays and what they then called Manila men, so from what we now call the Philippines, and who recruited these people, and they all intermarried. So, you know, basically everybody, all these different networks were then mingling. And, you know, a lot of it was indeed just happening up those streets from Central.
Yeah, it definitely puts faith to the kind of conventional theory that, you know, a bunch of white men landed on this rock, declared it as their own, and up the hill they marched.
Yeah, and I mean, I've got nothing against these white men, really. And I very much enjoyed, for example, when I was writing and researching the history of the Hong Kong Club, sort of the original archetypal core of these guys, literally from Jardine's, Dent's, the Augustine Heard and co, you know, the original Taipan traders out of Canton coming to Hong Kong and setting up their club. I mean, obviously, they were very important too in the making of Hong Kong. Yeah. I mean, the danger is, you know, I'm saying, oh, only these Eurasians were important. Of course, I'm not saying that.
No, those stories are well told.
Precisely, yes. And this was, it seemed to me, a story that hadn't properly been done yet. And we hadn't looked at it from this point of view. And so some of my friends who are, for example, now elder statespersons in a way of the Hong Kong Club, saying, you're just making us look like we're irrelevant. And I'm saying, no. No, you were also walking up the hill and having affairs, by the way. let's not pretend. So anyway, yeah, it just seemed to me that there was another way of looking at this whole process that in a way sort of hadn't been done yet. And it's still a sort of journalistic instinct. Like, let's find the story that has yet to be told.
That's really interesting, because especially with Hong Kong, you feel like it's been passed over and over, but actually it has. Clearly, there's this whole, like, you know, it's a spectrum and there's this whole wealth in between.
Yeah. And what I find a bit problematic sometimes, especially with people who don't know Hong Kong, but have seen it in the news in the last few years. Oh, so where are all these people now? And I'm saying, well, you know, I've written a history book. It basically stops in 19. I mean, I think you could stretch it to 1949. But then, of course, for publishers in the West, they want a summary at the end. So what's happened since then? Of course, my people in my book, you know, they're, again, they've taken completely diverse and different approaches to the late 20th and early 21st century. Some are still in Hong Kong, some are not, a lot are not. You know, that's a kind of natural process, I think. Families grow and get too big for the home base, and of course people go abroad for education or different professional things and don't come back and start new families elsewhere. So of course there's diasporas from what were originally diasporas coming to Hong Kong, making their home in Hong Kong, and then forming in effect new diasporas going elsewhere.
Yeah, but the institutions that they established over a century ago are still present, they're still active.
Good point, thank you.
And their, you know, their names are still on our road signs, on our hospitals. You see Ratanji Hospital. I didn't even know that was a past name. I knew it was someone's name. I knew it was from the colonial time. I just kind of assumed it was probably a British person.
Well, then you get into this saying, what is British?
Oh, yes. indeed. Yeah.
Which is a huge sort of, which we, you know, time is too short to go into. But again, the sort of first graduate out of the Hong Kong History Centre in Bristol is this brilliant woman called Vivian Kong, who's originally a Hong Kong U, you know, master's grad, who was then able to be the first person to be funded to go to Bristol, do her PhD, which is basically on the subject of, you know, what is Britishness. And she looks specifically at that moment in World War II, which I mentioned sort of in passing, when, you know, all British women and children must leave Hong Kong, you know, for their safety. So, you know, who qualified and who didn't and who wanted to go and who didn't want to go and so on. It's an extremely sort of messy moment. And, you know, and we all have that in our daily lives, in fact. And one of the people who advised me a whole lot and really was very helpful in this process is another historian called Christopher Munn. And he said, no, we've got to think about the extent to which we are all Eurasians now. You know, we are all, it's so politically charged now with words, you know. I at one point I wanted to say, oh, we're mongrels. Oh, no, you can't say that. but of course, we've all got different bits and pieces in us if we go and look for them.
Yeah. And I suppose because Hong Kong has played such a kind of pivotal international role in recent years, everyone's very interested in it. in its present format. And I suppose it was interesting reading your book and being like, goodness, this is so alien, this world that you've presented is so alien to the Hong Kong I see now. But then at the same time, it's not, you know, Hong Kong is much more diverse and multicultural than I imagined it would be before I arrived here.
Yeah, I find that this is, of course, there's a whole sort of large question lurking behind all this. Do you need diversity, however you want to define that, which is, again, one of these awfully mushy words? Do you need freedom of ideas and expression and possibility and the free movement of all kinds of different people?
Yeah.
Is that an essential characteristic of a port city, or is it just the sort of icing on the cake? You know, the airports work, the trade happens, you know, goods go back and forth regardless. And I think it has, and I'm not going to make any judgment about this because I'm kind of thinking about this for maybe a future project, but it clearly has something to do with, well, who is, however you want to say it, who is the power in charge, right? And what is the nature of that power? Now, I think, you know, the British can say what they like, but for large chunks of Hong Kong's existence, they basically really couldn't care less about Hong Kong. It was not top of their priority list. It was nice to have, but, you know, there were so much larger, more important things on their minds, in their minds, you know, it's the way they looked at it. And that was probably handy for Hong Kong, that you have a very large gap between you and your imperial power, both sort of physically and also conceptually. In that case, the mountains really were very high and the emperor was a very long way away. And then when you look at other empires like the Ottomans or the Austro-Hungarian and so on, I mean, these were huge umbrellas over what are now a dozen completely different countries and cultures and histories and languages, but they were all sort of labeled as part of an empire. So obviously it could only be called one great big sort of all-encompassing sort of empire if you are allowing all the component parts to really go their own way and be their own selves and sort of Greek, be Jewish, be Hungarian, be whatever. Now, we could argue that there's a couple of empires at work now for whom that is not the model, and that if a power needs everybody to behave the same and think the same and look the same and so on, I mean, that obviously will put real stresses on places which are just even just a little bit different in one way or another, you know. So, you know, there's obvious parallels. I'm not only talking about Asia, but, for example, you don't have to be Russian and love Putin to live in Russia, but it sure as hell helps. And, you know, there isn't a lot of room for whatever we might mean by diversity. So it depends, I think, on what is required of different component parts of a larger geopolitical construct. And certainly some of my people who I write about in the book are entirely happy staying in Hong Kong forever. They can't imagine living anywhere else. How could they? I mean, their entire heritage and life and home and always has been and always will be, no matter what. That's absolutely fine. Why not? That's how they feel. Others say, well, you know, they felt that there was a bit more room to be different. Maybe in the 80s, I think the 1980s was an interesting time when basically everybody was ignoring Hong Kong and left it to its own devices, sort of between empires, you know, and if they feel that they're constrained in some way, of course they can leave. So they do.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose that's how people have their say these days. So in the book you wrote, and this is very diplomatic, that Hong Kong's history is being disputed. Does that make your job as a historian more difficult or even more pressing?
Yes, to all of the above. I mean, of course, we're of or in Hong Kong, and so we think particularly about what's going on in Hong Kong. It's the same everywhere, anywhere, anytime. I mean, I would probably have trouble in New Zealand these days, where I haven't lived since I was 10. But now, and I can assure you, with back then, the notion that, you know, I would need to be able to speak Maori, or at least, you know, be able to toss Maori words into conversation sort of willy-nilly, had not crossed anybody's mind, as far as I know. And now, I mean, I'm quite sure I couldn't get a job in media or government or anything unless I was totally with the program which is about, you know, reinstating the centrality of the Maori experience in New Zealand history. I mean, I just use this example because it's quite exotic, I expect, to a Hong Kong listener, but it's clearly something that's really shifted in a generation in New Zealand. And, you know, there are articles written about New Zealand and I don't understand half of them because they're using all sorts of words that I've never heard come about.
Right.
So, you know, every country rewrites its history, all of the time. So every country has its program. Clearly in Hong Kong, it's highly politicized now and it's much tougher. If you want to say something different to the official narrative, clearly, you know, that's not a smart thing to do. And that official narrative, I mean, it has the advantage of being very clear. You know what it is.
You know what it is.
You know what it is. Although I was interested the other day, and this is just in little steps, which is quite fascinating. And it was a story in the excellent Hong Kong Free Press, which told me that a journalist had asked a question about the demonstrators of 2019 and was told that we don't call them demonstrators anymore. Was it black violence?
Black violence, yeah.
Black violence, I think.
Yeah.
So, okay, so that's the new line. So it's interesting, I think, for a historian, it's a bit easier maybe to step back even further than you do as a journalist, where you say, well, what does this tell us about the people in charge at the moment? Well, they want to exert control of the narrative. They want to tell us what words to use. Now, it's interesting because historically you can pretty much, I think, always prove it doesn't really work. But it happens everywhere all the time. That's what politicians do. Obviously, the price of countervailing the dominant narrative varies. If you object to the Russian narrative, there's a pretty high price to pay. If you are in Ukraine as a journalist, for example, and if you want to do something that is not only about Ukraine as our valiant victims, that's also difficult to do. But again, the price for breaking those rules varies.
I suppose it kind of goes to prove that the collections like Carl Smith's are essential and that accessibility to them is equally important.
It is vital. I mean, we of course know what we mean by journalism as a first draft of history. You know, people need to bear witness no matter what. Historians, I mean, I think this is why we, and certainly in my case, I mean, I've even gone to the extent of forming a company with two archivists. It's called History Inc. Limited. And we're all just sort of obsessive about this thing about you've just got to keep records. You may be able to look into them or use them now, or you may not be able to say what you want with them in this time and place, but, you know, in a decade, in a century from now, they hold immense value. So, and it goes right down to the number of people I've interviewed who, my family's not important, this. Oh, and I say, yeah, but, you know, what about your photo album? Oh, you don't want to look at those. And I'm saying, no, yes, I do. And then it's gold. And just one wedding photo, you can sort of trace the mix of people and where they're all from in one photo. You know, there's a whole story in that. And that there's value, irreplaceable value, in raw, original records, and they need to be kept in a safe place. And people will read different things into them at different times. Of course they will.
Yeah.
But they still need to be there.
It's incredibly interesting, definitely. I was like, in my head, I was trying to map out all the family trees of everybody.
Oh, I had to get big pieces of paper, different colored pens. Start with this lady and, oh, she slept with this guy, but then she slept with that guy, and then those things happened, then they married, and then, you know, it became a complete sort of beyond octopus sort of mess, you know, lines going all over the place. But I would trace the colours, and then you end up with this row of names along the bottom, and you think, oh, there it is, the late 19th century elite. And it goes back to four women who worked very hard.
I think you also mentioned in the book that the role of women in Hong Kong's history or early history is often, if not ignored, then just not visible because of the lack of first-hand recordings.
I mean, that's, of course, another just fundamentally but huge issue about archives or records is what is recorded. who decides what records are important and what is kept. So, for example, when I was researching and writing the history of the Harry Layla family, that was very interesting because they were extremely poor in the 1920s and 1930s, and they're just not in the records. You know, they're living in an incredibly, in one room in a shared tenement in Shamsi-Po. And, you know, the government inspectors are not coming by and writing down everybody's names, or they're not in the system yet. Who announces the birth or death of somebody in a newspaper? You know, that already says who's being recorded.
Right,
so
indeed, yeah.
You have to kind of question the source each time. But the point about women is that, of course, and I'm sorry to say, most of them were illiterate. So, you know, they were not keeping a diary. Today, I serviced Mr. X and he was a drag. No, you know, we don't hear that. We don't have their voice. Whereas, of course, we have Victor Deakin, the first lawyer, who's actually, in some cases, officiating, notarizing the property exchanges between the Western merchant and his so-called protected woman, his in-house lady. And Deakin, of course, writes letters and keeps records. In fact, Deakin's archive, brilliantly, is at Hong Kong University Special Collections. So the men kept notes, the women didn't. I'm generalizing.
Yeah.
So that's problem number one. I think there's a larger problem, and it's also why this whole history of how these clans began, i.e. it began with sex with a local woman, why it was so often and for so long ignored is that, well, they're only women and they're native women, is both racist and misogynist, that these people don't matter. Whereas in fact, of course, they're central to the business. And that was, you know, some of my early conversations and people would be saying, so, but how did it really happen? And I said, well, you know, you've heard of sex. Well, where? Oh, well, brothels? No, not only, of course. And it becomes much more interesting and complex than that. And then different attitudes from different cultures to those kinds of relationships. There was a very nice review of my book in the Sunday Times, and it sort of brushes over the fact, it talks about how the women were the making of Hong Kong, which is good. But of course, it's not that the women had any choice. It's not like they sat back in China and thought, oh, I think I'll go and be a sex worker in Hong Kong and get ahead. You know, I mean, a large majority of them were trafficked in the first place into Hong Kong and had very, very little freedom of maneuver. The majority of them were just used up and discarded. The ones who did manage to parlay their connections with wealthy men into wealth of their own, that obviously, I imagine, would be the dream of anyone working in that field. And I say all power to them. You know, I mean, I imagine with any of us when we're in that situation, you know, just make sure you get paid well and that you get what you need out of it eventually. Some of these women manage that, by no means all, probably not even the majority. And what's also really interesting is that there they are being so sort of mostly used, abused. Not all Western merchants were nice guys. Not all of them paid properly. Not all of them left property in their name. Not at all. Of course they didn't. So they're enduring, they're surviving all of that, just point one, to survive. But then the ones who really make progress are the ones who make sure that their kids are going to get what they never had. Their kids are going to get an education.
Yeah.
Their children are going to have the opportunity to make their way in the world and not, you know, have to sort of live off the streets, basically. And then it's kind of interesting, and this was, again, when I realized that this whole world in Hong Kong had been ignored, I went to a talk, which was fascinating. Emma Chang has written this brilliant book just called Eurasian, and she is a Chinese-American academic. And, you know, Hong Kong gets a look in, but is not the whole focus of the book. She gave a talk about it, and she was basically talking about Shanghai and how there was this multicultural school in Shanghai and, you know, how marvelous this was. And I was thinking, well, hang on a bit. You know, Hong Kong already had half a dozen in multicultural, multi-faith, multi-racial schools at that time. So I didn't make myself very popular at the talk, but it's really true. I mean, it's, you know, for all sorts of nutty mixed motives, things happen, sort of unintended consequences. So you set up a school to educate girls, and then you're sort of shocked because it turns out that they raised their price in the market because, ooh, they speak English too. Yeah. So we can sell her to a Western merchant instead of, you know, just a Chinese or something, or maybe a richer Chinese who wants to pretend he speaks English or something, you know. And so, of course, the good church ladies freaked out. It's a fascinating process. But again, there are women who managed to get through it, and who, through their sons and sometimes daughters, were able to kind of triumph over all these impediments. So, yeah, I'd love to know more about these women, and I'd love to find out more about what they actually felt. But how on earth do you, you know, it's 1860s, they didn't write. It's really hard. Yeah. You know, there's a lot more to be found out, mm-hmm. I'm sure.
In the book, you ask this question, I think more than once, of like, what is Hong Kong? And which is, I know it's an unanswerable question, because I don't know what I would do if someone asked me it, but I'm going to ask it to you. So to you, what is Hong Kong?
What was or what is? Well, I think my definition now, after all this sort of obsession for years, is it was a link in this chain of Asian port cities. It grew out of the long pre-established trade routes right through Middle East, across through South Asia, through Southeast Asia. And along the way, you get port cities founded, you know, Bombay, Calcutta, Rangoon, Penang, Singapore, Batavia, Makassar, Malacca, Bangkok. I mean, you know, I'm not putting these in the right chronological area, the order. And of course, Canton, Nagasaki, and Hong Kong. Now, in that chain, Hong Kong's quite a late developer. Yeah. It's almost an afterthought. When you start looking at it on a scale of, let's go back to, for example, the 900s, when you had Muslim traders in Canton, nobody even thought about Hong Kong at that point. It just sort of popped up quite late. Definitely a late developer. Maybe that's why I like it. And so it was part of this network of Asian trade and Asian port cities. Of course, and what we've barely talked about, but I state quite clearly in the book, I'm deliberately ignoring, of course, the numerical majority of Hong Kong, who are one kind or another of Chinese, a lot of quite different Chinese. You know, people also came from different parts of China for different reasons at different times. They basically came and went a lot, whereas my people, they came and stayed.
Yeah.
That's kind of a difference, because they didn't have anywhere else to go, whereas a Chinese could come to Hong Kong for a few years and think, oh, fed up here, I'll go back to China. And that basically happened really until the 1960s. You don't get a majority of Hong Kong-born Chinese until after World War II, which I was just absolutely gobsmacked by that. So this whole idea that when whoever wants to say, oh, Hong Kong's always been a Chinese city, well, I mean, yes, there's been an awful lot of Chinese in it, but is that its essential character? It's part of it. It's not the whole story. It's an Asian city, and it's an Asian hub. And I've discovered, I've just moved into the present tense, and I think it would be and I guess it's no secret in the book, I think it would be a pity to lose that wider place in the world, that wider mix of people. In fact, it was somebody from, I think, Victor Lee, the Lee and Fung Institute. They came up one time with this image of a hourglass, you know, the thing with the sand falls from the top to the bottom and then you turn it over. That Hong Kong is that knot in the middle. So, yes, if you want to say China is on top, fine. But exactly the same size, Asia is of at least equal importance. Mm-hmm. And okay, you can turn it up the other way around. It doesn't matter who's on top or who's on bottom. But the point is, they are of equal importance in the making of Hong Kong. It is not only China. Mm-hmm. So I guess I would say that Hong Kong is an Asian city. The Chinese component is hugely important, but it's not the only one.
That's it for this week's episode. Thanks for listening to my conversation with Vodine England. You can find Fortune's Bazaar online and in all good bookshops. You've been listening to Yum Cha. Hong Kong Free Press podcast with me, Mercedes Hutton. For more informative and impartial coverage, and to learn how to support our journalist-led newsroom, visit hongkongfp.com.